Welcome to the New Books Network.
Morning, Chief.
You ready to go home? Or do you have a home? Your brother wanted me to let you out. Up to me. I'll let you stay here another couple of days or a week, maybe a month.
What do you want me to do, thank him?
Disgusting. You're uncontrollable, you know? Give him a bath. How to wrap you one.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dan.
And I'm Mike.
So welcome back to 15 Minute Film Fanatics, a podcast where two lifelong friends and film fans watch movies separately and talk about them on the show for the first time. What movie are we doing today, Mike?
We Own the Night.
We Own the Night, 2007, written and directed by James Gray. In part one, we always talk about our overall take on the movie. And the rule is the guy who suggests the movie lets the other guy go first. So I saw this movie on Criterion. I thought it was terrific, and I texted Mike, and I said, you got to see this movie for the podcast. We have not said word one to each other about this movie, have we, Mike?
Not a word.
Not a word. So here we go. Part one, overall, Mike, what was your take on We Own the Night?
I guess the first thing that strikes me is that I didn't even know that this movie existed. If right before this conversation you had said, did you know that Joaquin Phoenix was in a movie with Mark Wahlberg? I would say I definitely didn't know that. And then you might say, well, guess who else is in it? And I would say, I don't know. You'd be like, Eva Mendes, right? Who else is in it?
Robert Duvall,
right? So it has a great cast. And I think that my overall impression of this movie is it's a little bloated on runtime, but that may just be a personal preference. But the performances are really what carry this movie. I mean, it's underrated in the sense that I've never heard of it. I don't really even know its writer or director, but apparently this movie's just some kind of open secret. It's not the movie that I thought it was, you know, trying to watch a trailer. This movie is very, very, very interesting. It's action-packed, but it's really about, it's a moral drama, but set in the 80s in Queens. And I didn't know that Mark Wahlberg really had it in him.
You knew that because you love The Departed so much.
Well, I was going to say it's almost as good as what he did in the Departed. But in The Departed, I thought he was just playing some kind of caricature of himself as Dingham, which he is. Joaquin Phoenix is always weird. He just has an interesting face. And I think he knows he has an interesting face and he uses it well. And really great performance, of course, by Robert Duvall and by Eva Mendes. I don't want to give too much of the plot away, but what was your overall take?
My overall take is that it's so refreshing to see a movie for grownups, isn't it? Like, that's what's so great about this, right? So I looked on IMDb. The budget for this movie was $21 million. So let's compare that with some recent movies, right? Madam Web, this giant, terrible Marvel movie that got made that bombed, $80 million. Dune Part 2. Take a guess at how much Dune Part 2 cost to make, if you had a guess.
$200 million?
$190 million. So this is pretty good. So this was $21 million. And that's what I love about it. You know what I love about this? This is going to sound silly, like it's not an endorsement, but it is. I love that it's not mind-blowing.
I get what you mean.
You know what I mean, right? Like, yeah. At the end, you don't find out like the Russians are really in a giant conspiracy with the cops and Robert Duvall had this secret life selling, you know, selling heroin on the streets, but lying. Like, there's no giant aha. Like in The Departed, there's like The Departed, which we love, ends like 10 times with all the reversals. I like that it's just like, it's about adults caught in a bad situation that try to work their way out of it. And I think James Gray is really good at that. His previous movie was called The Yards.
And that's
about Mark. That's good. It's about Mark Wahlberg getting out of prison and coming back. And it's a classic movie thing. Like, you got to do one more job. You got to drive the car for us. And he had another movie called Little Odessa. Those are all pretty good. But I think We Own the Night is really, really great. You mentioned how good Joaquin Phoenix is and how good Mark Wahlberg is. I love what you just said about his looks, because they look like real people. Like, imagine the impulse that had to be there to say, okay, we're going to have, even though they're too old for it, but I guess they could de-age them. Imagine we're going to have like Al Pacino play the Joaquin Phoenix part and Robert Redford play the Mark Wahlberg. Like, it wouldn't work. For the same reason that you couldn't have guys that look like Mark Wahlberg and Joaquin Phoenix in The Sting or Butch Cassidy, right?
And there are two kind of gaspy moments. The first is, I really love how the movie sets you up to think that these are parallel narratives, and then Joaquin Phoenix shows up at the party for Mark Wahlberg's promotion.
Isn't that great?
Right? And he tells Amada, you can't tell anybody about this, because if you tell anybody about this, they're going to kill us. And then there's kind of a rhyming moment at the end where you find out that Murat was okay with his nephew Vadim the whole time. Yeah. And he only pretended not to like him, or, you know, I can't control what that kid does. But of course he was in on it, and he was moving coke and heroin through the club. Now, that's not a crazy reversal of what you see in The Departed, right? You're not stunned by it. You're just disappointed. You're morally hurt and disappointed somehow that old man is not as innocent as he would appear. Because I think what this movie sets you up to do is you want to believe that one last person could say that they're involved, but they're innocent, right? When he goes to see his father, Robert Duvall, and his brother, Mark, he says, listen, whatever is done at the club, I don't know about it. And they say, no, we checked you out. You're clean, you know, which seems deeply naive, but that naivete is partly what pushes you through the first 2 hours to the, you know, conclusion for the last 20 minutes, I think.
We are not vaguely, we are disappointed by people's actions in this movie, as opposed to having stunning revelations about people's real identity, like The Departed, right? What's that remind you of? Life, right? We don't go through life constantly amazed that somebody's a different person than we thought. But as Stacey Keach, the actor, once said, I think it was Stacey Keach said, I expect nothing from people and I'm still disappointed. This movie also reminds us that if you're ever asked to wear a wire in a movie, don't. Has there ever been a movie where somebody successfully wore a wire?
I don't think so. I like to, speaking of disappointments in this movie, the disappointment of Jumbo.
Oh,
you know, when he's sitting down, you find out that he knew what motel he was.
Yeah.
Where he was the entire time. Just, and then Eva Mendes leaves. I mean, you don't blame Amada for leaving, but there's that glimmer at the end when he thinks that he sees her in the crowd, and right, it's just some other woman sitting there.
Yeah.
This movie just hurts.
It hurts. And it reminds me of other movies we like. It reminds me of On the Waterfront, where kind of like, obviously the brothers, but also like, you know, how am I supposed to live my life? And also Angels with Dirty Faces. It's got this vibe to it of, you know, which way are you supposed to go? And I still love you, even though you're a bad person. And that's something that people say all the time. It's a bad line in novels. I do love you, even though you're a different person. But like, to really dramatize that, I think this movie does it well. And I keep going back to this. It does it so well on a small scale. I mean, yeah, the car chase in the rain, unbelievably great. I think that's so, like, how do you make a new car chase? He did it. There's moments of great intensity when he's wearing the wire and they're in the heroin factory, the shootout at the end. But I really don't think that, I don't recommend this movie to people because it's got unbelievable over the top action sequences. I recommend it to people because it's about real people going through stuff that they kind of have to like figure it out.
Yeah, there's something beautiful about how Mark Wahlberg's character Joseph is not ready to take his brother back in when he joins the cops. It's like, thank you for wearing the wire or doing whatever it was, or getting shot or throwing yourself out a window, but we'll take it from here. He's not included in the conversation. That's such a brother's thing. And the his little house just looks so dingy.
Oh, the sets are great.
Right. It doesn't his house look dingy where they're throwing the welcome home party and everybody has their little slice of cake?
Yeah.
You know, and of course they're trying to they're discussing how to take down the most notorious drug ring in Queens, you know, with their little piece of cake. And anybody in the most simple drive by could have killed them all. Yeah, you feel very exposed. There's something deeply un-Hollywood about this movie that really appeals to me.
It also reminds me, one more thing before we go to part two, it reminds me very much of a movie we did for the podcast, I don't know, a year or two ago, that we both love, was, how much does this movie remind you of Prince of the City?
Yeah, it's very much like an updated version of Prince in the City. The different artistic visions, I think, but the impact is similar.
Yeah. There's no big car chases or excitement like that in Prince of the City, but the same kind of sordidness and the same kind of like moment where, and we'll get to this in part three, where the cops will ask themselves, is this worth it? Like, remember in Prince of the City, Treat Williams, his big moment is like, why am I doing this? Like, why do you have to be the guy that's got to clean up the police force? And he doesn't even know why he wants to do it. He just thinks that it's vaguely wrong. And that's kind of going on here too.
Yeah, the only thing I find vaguely unrealistic is that there is an impulse by the cops as they're talking about the mob to just kill them all. We've seen them in the street. We know where they live. Why don't we just do it? And it's Robert Duvall's character that tries to stop them from devolving into the mob, although we know from Prince in the City that they don't. Welcome back. So in part two, of course, we talk about our key scenes. Dan, why don't you get us started?
So my moment is when the cops come to Robert Duvall and he knows that one of his kids is in trouble. One of the boys has been shot or killed or something's horrified. And he says, which one? Now, whatever answer he gets is going to be sad. Whatever answer he gets is going to be terrible. Either the good son, the cop, was shot. And he does get shot earlier in the movie. That's what it's about. Or it's going to be my screw up son finally did one thing too much and got in over his head. And of course, this movie draws upon a famous story about a father and a son. It's about the prodigal son, right? The return of the prodigal son. So that's a story from the Bible that I assume all of our listeners know. But I want to talk for a second about why I never understood that story when I was little. So when I was a kid, I would get told the story of the prodigal son. And as our listeners may remember, there's two sons. The one good son stays home. The other son, the prodigal, goes out, spends his inheritance, ends up living among the pigs. He comes crawling back. And when he comes crawling back to his father, what does his father say, Mike?
Welcome home.
Welcome home, right? He's happy for him. And do you remember what the other son says?
Why are you throwing this party for this screw up?
Yeah, exactly, right? So I was a kid hearing that story. I would sit in church and think the same thing. I'm like, man, what the heck is going on? Why does the other kid get the party? That's not right. What are you talking about? The older son should get the party. He did all the things he's supposed to do. He did his chores. How come the screw up gets the party? Now, of course, you understand that story much later in life when you become a father, because that's what it's about, right? It's about forgiveness. And I think that story is so great because it's so human. It's so about human nature, right? People are going to screw up and they have to come back. And when you're a kid, when I was a kid, I thought there should be absolute rules. Because when you're a kid, that's how you see the universe. Like, that's not fair. That's wrong. That's right. Everything is black and white. And I love this movie because in that moment when Robert Duvall says, which one, you see his pain about whatever kid it's going to be. And I think that's what this, you know, the guy's name is James Gray, and not to be too cute, but you know, there's a lot of gray in this movie that I really admire.
One thing that's not is my moment, which is when Joseph gets shot. I don't really have a lot on it. That's just one of the best shootings that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Right. You do something dramatic. Right. But then again, you're in your dingy home on your dingy street. They don't glorify the life of cops.
No,
you know, this isn't The Shield with two other friends. You know, chilling on your deck to make sure that you don't get shot. He comes out of his house because he got to work late and his wife doesn't want him to leave. And he bends down to tie his shoes or whatever. And he's already made the mistake because they're already waiting for him. And somebody just walks up to him casually and, you know, puts a bullet in his cheek.
Yeah.
Which it's stunning. But I think one of the ways that Hollywood does these kinds of scenes where a key character gets popped, what they do is they take the drama and the force out of it by over teasing the suspense in a way. And there's no suspense about this moment. Whatever's coming for you has already gotten into position by the time you realize it. And that's where the audience has to sit during that scene. And you think to yourself, there's no way that they killed Mark Wahlberg half an hour into this movie, which of course they didn't, but it's a stunning moment. It's almost like the Janet Leigh moment in Psycho,
absolutely. Yeah, that's great because I remember watching it the first time and thinking to myself, I wonder when this movie's going to go up a notch or what's going to happen. And then all of a sudden he gets shot in the face and you're like, oh my God, because, you know, we love to use the phrase plot armor. Mark Wahlberg has plot armor. His name is above the title. It's his movie. He can't die half an hour into it. But it reminded me of imagine the first audiences to see The Godfather when Brando gets shot that many times in the street and Fredo sits on the curb, starts crying. Like, there had to be audiences who are like, wait, what? Like, Marlon, I thought this was Marlon Brando's big return. Like, what's going on? And I think to pull that off is a real testament to that. Because you're right, there's no setup, there's no ominous music. He lives in that house. He's a cop because his father was, but also because he thinks it's the right thing to do. He's not James Bond. He's not Jackie Chan. He's just
not, he's not James Bond. He doesn't disarm his attacker at the last second, right. and then the big news is somebody tried to kill your son. You know, he's in the ICU. He may have to relearn how to talk.
Yeah.
You know,
and then
he's
out of the movie
good.
For like half an hour.
Yeah.
And it, like, so that's a really great touch. Welcome back. In part three, we always talk about the title or the ending or our big takeaways. So Mike, where do you want to start?
Well, I think that the idea behind this movie is an interesting one, despite there's a seeming lack of art in some of these scenes that this director doesn't really impose himself. He lets things play out. He lets the sets kind of speak for themselves. There are two great action scenes that require a lot of editing. But there's something that hangs in the back of this movie that I think is really interesting, which is the question that the characters seem to ask themselves, which is the juice worth the squeeze? Is it worth what we're doing and what's going on here? And I think it would be very difficult not to read this as a kind of a cultural metaphor of post-Vietnam war on drugs America, you know, that some of the habits that people picked up in Vietnam by being sent to do things, coming back over here, and then us experiencing as a country immense affluence, and that affluence bringing darkness. What you could possibly do as one person or even a group of people about it, right? Bobby's like, well, I've carved out a niche for myself. Is it my responsibility? You know, Joseph is saying, okay, I could do it, but I have to take out my brother, right? Eva Mendes says, okay, we've already done our part. And we've lived, do we have to do more, right? Remember when she finds out that he's going to take the police exam.
Right.
And she says, you made this decision without me. And so the question is, right, is this war on drugs in this movie, is it worth it because of the immense violence and poking the bear that it entails? And what are you actually trying to get accomplished? I think it plays a little bit to both sides, but it ends up on the side of yes.
Yes, it is worth it. Absolutely. Because my question was, who's the we? So in the title, We Own the Night, right? That's obviously from the police thing we see in the beginning, but that it makes you think, who's the we? Who really does own the night? And who wants, it's about, you know, the Russians versus the cops trying to own the night. And I think at the end, when Bobby becomes a cop, like if somebody wanted to complain about the movie, I guess you could say that happens really quickly. Like all of a sudden he's taking the police exam and then it ends with him becoming a cop. And you might say that's a little too pat, but certainly the movie says that, yeah, it is kind of worth it. I mean, this movie takes place in 1988. And I think that the movie kind of, it toys with this idea, like, should you just throw up your hands? But ultimately Bobby's like, no, you shouldn't. And Joseph says, no, you shouldn't either, because it's the same reason why Joseph lives in that house. Like, it's the right thing to do. And that's what we're going to do. So ultimately the title means like, no, we, the good guys should own the night. And you can make an argument for saying, oh yeah, legalize drugs. We see how that's gone in the country now, that there are states now reversing their laws to legalize drugs. So I just think the movie comes down, like you said, it might toy with it back and forth because you get sucked in with the human drama, but ultimately you're proud of Bobby at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I appreciate the way that it invites the question.
Yeah.
In ambiguity, because it's neither it's neither Serpico, you know, nor is it Asphalt Jungle.
Right.
It's neither one of those two. It really explores the cost, and I think one of the ways that it explores the cost is by not having Amada come back to Bobby.
Yes.
Right. Because people don't pay fake costs in this movie. They pay real costs, right? Like you come to appreciate Robert Duvall as both the father and the lieutenant commissioner. But once he's killed in that movie, he's gone from the movie forever. I think that this movie stops to weigh the consequences and plays with ambiguity in an interesting way.
Thank you for listening, everybody. We hope you enjoyed our conversation about We Own the Night. You could follow us on X at 15minfilm. You could also follow us where, Mike?
Letterboxd.
Follow us on Letterboxd. Let us know what to watch next. We'll see you next time.